At that time, the Temple of Apis could have been built. It would have just meant that in the Roman Empire to which Alexandria belonged, there was then a victorious march of paganism. However, 395, I also told you, was the time when St. Augustine wrote the City of God and said that. You haven't even understood that much. That's the one part of the glow of the firmament which is left out from our visible movements of the stars is the north, where the stars never set. The northern star you can find every evening, can't you? How do you get the northern star? How do you find the polar star, Sarkar? What do you do to see the polar star? And then? Well, you know something. The biggest star in the sky at night is which star? Which is the most luminous star? Sirius, gentlemen. And that comes from the spreader, Sirius. You don't have to know the root, but you cannot write Sirius as one of you has done thereof. Again, the man in his report, Mr. Davidson, where is he? Write Sirius, because the only word he can connect with Sirius, the star Sirius, is the country of Syria, obviously. Where the name of the star Sirius has nothing to do with this gentleman. When a man writes a report, he simply has to look up his spelling. He cannot spill this out like beans and write Sirius. I must say, when the biggest star in the night sky, if this is unknown to you, I don't know again. This has nothing to do with humanity. It has even to do with your beloved science. Then Mr. Mitchell, where is he? Not here? Mitchell. Well, you write, instead of Montezuma, you write Cortez. And then I think a more universal mistake, and that's something I think you should then throw out and not use it. There are difficult words like symbol, which perhaps are beyond your understanding. I have a hunch that this word symbol better should be avoided between you and me. And I have tried to do so. We can live without symbols, perhaps the word symbol. But if you use it, you have to use it right here. This number of the Olympic Games every 4 years, you see, I said is the same as is 4 times 365. So the day and the year are symbolized as the same. Where they aren't symbolized as the same, but they are symbolizing the same. Isn't that right? But active and passive are confused. I have the feeling that the word is sick. How can it happen that you say that the day and the year are symbolized as the same? They aren't. They themselves are the symbols. So that's... it only goes to show that the American language is... has broken away from English totally. Such difficult words as symbols are just beyond your associations. Wouldn't you agree that symbol is today bandied around? And it's the same with the word myth, of course. I've tried to give you some help in its use so that you do not fall into the traps. This cheap use of myth is everything, from shaving cream to Elvis. So now let's go on to the next symbol. Mr. Michelson, here. Would you be good enough, baby? Oh, you don't want to, huh? Well, how do you feel? Here's some long letter I haven't, you see, I hadn't seen this. You try it. Symbolized by this report. I'm afraid so. I'm very glad I found out about you, of course, without reading your letter in magazine. It was perfectly okay. Gentlemen, the breaking of the taboos of the tribe and of Egypt is the first concern of the new order of Israel. And therefore, if you look around in this room, you find all kind of vestiges of Greek and other artistic endeavors, but nothing Jewish. The Jews make the sacrifice of no art, no painting, no graven images. The abstemiousness of Judaism is that there can be no divinity in the visible world if you want to preach the coming of the Lord. The Jews have created that on which modern science is based, the dismissal of the world as purely the world, not the container of God. There would be no physics today and no chemistry if people still would believe, as in Greece, that Artemis was the goddess of the woods, because then you cannot analyze wood. You have to sacrifice to the goddess of the forest. You don't know this. You always are told that the Greeks are the creator of modern science. That's nonsense. They were not. In the year 100 of our era, at the end of the Greek cycle, the Greeks were back to all kind of superstitions, and science made not the slightest progress. There was no research going on in the Roman Empire. But the Jews created this freedom that the Egyptian cosmos or the Chinese cosmos was nothing compared to the Sabbath rest of men's soul with God, that men could look down from God's seat into the heavens with astronomy and into the earth with geology, let me say, without being overawed and following the commands of the some stars by marching in an astrological vicious circle. You see, wheels within wheels, years within years, great years within great years, revolutions within revolutions, horoscopes within horoscopes, constellations within constellations. Of all this, the Israelites have freed us. You are not under the rule of the stars. If you are, you are just an idiot. And you are not under the rules of your ancestors. The dead do not judge the quick. Now, the breaking of the taboos in Israel, I would like to then to say, consists first in abolishing the speech of the pictures. The Hebrew Bible is written in a new alphabet, in an alphabet that has no pictures. The great basis of the Jewish revelation, of the Jewish Bible, is that it is not written in hieroglyphs, not in pictorial writing, you see, but in these abstract letters, which are purely, as we call them, phonetic. As you know, the consonants, the syllable, it's a syllable writing without any claim of sanctity. The Chinese or the Egyptian lettering is the way by which you recognize an Egyptian or a Chinese. That is, he must bow to these pictures. And the Hebrew alphabet is merely one of pure sound. This is nothing dismissed as worldly. So we find that Judaism begins with a secularization, with a dismissal of certain bonds by which the cosmos is sacred. It desecrates that which is not sacred. And if you would begin to imagine, gentlemen, that these words, secularism and world, are must be penetrated by you, then you will understand that the word world itself had to be created. For the tribe, the corpse of the ancestor, the eye of the ancestor, his arrow and his mask were sacred. For the Egyptians, the Nile was sacred, and the stars were sacred.
for the Jews, whose God had created heaven and earth, neither the heavens nor the earth are sacred. Can you see the immensity of this step? God is sacred. God is called in the Bible time and again the Holy One. And you know all this, I hope you all know that great hymn, Holy, Holy, Holy.
Now you must read this word Sanctus, Sanctus, Sanctus in the Mass, or in the Protestant hymn, it's translated into this hymn 250 in the Congregational Hymn Book, Holy, Holy, Holy. That
this is a victory over the many sacraments and the many sacred things, you see, that the tribe and the empire had to worship. The golden calf, for example. You see, I only have to tell you this. Nothing visible is sacred.
Nothing visible is sacred. Another way, as I said, the price paid for it is no art. No art. As you know, to this day, the Muslims have inherited part of this taboo that they are not allowed to give graven images. Now, gentlemen, this has great importance even to our days. I'll give you a little continuation of this breaking of the taboo in the Christian era, which after all translates Judaism into, brings it into the pagan world. It was forbidden in the Christian church to paint a picture of God the Father down to 1,100 in the West. And the same taboo, the same no trespassing, was retained in the Russian church, in the Greek Orthodox church, down to 1600. The rifts in the Russian church and the driving out of the sects in the 17th century had much to do with the resistance of these fundamentalists in the Eastern Church against this insolence of Renaissance to depict, to paint God the Father. The Christian compromise was from the beginning that the Son, who had become man, could be painted, but the Father could not. And that is the compromise between Israel, you see, and the pagan world, that in the Trinity, and that's why there has to be the Trinity for your understanding of the divine, God the Son can be painted. If the Lord is reproduced, gentlemen, in the green pastures, that's the end of Christianity. If he can come under this, upon the stage, that's just funny. Gangway for the Lord. That's a joke, and it's, I think, a very poor joke. It is only can only come from this condescension the white man has in this country for the Negro. I think the Negro was, no, the Negroes know much better that God cannot be seen, because they had to believe in the invisible God in their slavery. There was nothing around them which professed anything divine in the slave gang in Georgia. So if you don't believe in the invisible God in prison, or in a mine, or in a concentration camp, you are lost. Very easy for you to believe in God in your little church or in St. John the Divine. That has nothing to do with God himself, it's just a superstition. God is invisible, or he is not God. That must remain, gentlemen. That's the contribution of each Israel. As soon as you think that God can be painted, you are ridiculous. And worse than this, you are blasphemers. And that's as true as it always has been, gentlemen, and it will never change. This country is just full of blasphemy in this respect. You just can't paint God. Mr. Orozco had a very fine feeling for this when he had to say something about God rejecting mankind on this continent four times. But he changed the appearance. He has got twice as in a naive way, as you know, the white father, and then at the end he has him as Christ, and in the middle he when he gives him a little red schoolhouse and the American you see, situation which he also wants to reject, it is in a, so to speak, invisible way that God laughs at this hypocrisy and Phariseeism of America. I think he fails in the final picture of the working man, this Mongolian tribe reading a book. He himself said that he didn't paint what he had in mind to paint, and it has remained, so to speak, inarticulate. So Mr. Orozco, I think, has tried to give God more than one appearance in order not to be caught in any one stable image of the divine. That would be a long story to study, and I think, who is majoring in the arts? Anybody in the arts department here? Would be a great theme, the greatest perhaps at our this moment, gentlemen. One of the reasons why the artists today go abstract and have this abstract art, you see, has of course to do with a deep feeling that the visible must not have authority for their spirit. It's a kind of attempt, you see, to get behind the grave images, behind the depiction of nature as though this could be divine. It's a new attempt to let the world be the world. And the world is not sacred, you see, and the world is not law. So our modern crisis in the pictorial arts is of very great significance and deserves your respect. These people are wrestling with a profoundly religious problem. And the 19th century and life that photographs religions all over the world just show you in what a dead avenue we have gotten ourselves. They would like to photograph the future. Of course they would. They asked me to do so. They wanted, I was asked to write a series of articles about the future, and they wanted then to have the photographs of the houses in which the people whom I had fathomed to be ancestors of the future, where they were born. Well, I said, these houses in which they were born, they have to leave behind. They have to fall dead into the ground. That's the past. If you give the birthplace of somebody who deserves mentioning, you see, then it is to show that despite the fact that he was born in Hannibal, Ohio, he became Mark Twain. There's a difference, gentlemen. People who believe in the coming of the Lord are everything what they are despite their environment and their background. And the men who never became anything are everything because of their background and their environment. The environment is Egypt, their background is the tribe. If you are a tribesman, you are what you are because you are your grandfather's grandson. Isn't that obvious? If you are an Egyptian, you are what you are because you live in Egypt. But if you are a child of God, you become what you are despite the fact that Moses was born in Egypt, you see, and Abraham was born in Ur, and in Harar, lived in Harar, he became Abraham, the man who lived by faith alone, and was justified not because he came from Harar or because he was a Semite, but despite the fact that he was a Semite and despite the fact that he came from Harar in Babylonia. You all have to make this decision, gentlemen, sometime in your life. Some good things we are because, and some good things, better things we are despite. Perhaps you take this down, gentlemen, that Israel is the creation of the despite. And Egypt and the tribes are the orders of the because. So, gentlemen, Israel has as its greatest celebration the Day of Atonement. What is atonement? At-one-ment. And therefore, it is the day at which Israel is excused. Because what is it to excuse? To break the causes. Israel is a people of God despite its shortcomings that it has 12 tribes and a country to defend, little Palestine. Despite. Therefore, it needs a day at which it rests assured
that although it has to breathe, to eat, to live, to plow the, till the soil, as any other tribe and nation to beget children, it still is ready for the coming of the Lord. Can you understand? That to remain sin-free and fleet-footed and to be ready to leave one's homeland and one's ancestors is the sign of the faithful. And therefore the Day of Atonement is the centerpiece of the Jewish faith, the Jewish unity. That there is one day in the year where all the vows, all the environmental and background dependencies are shelved and man stands ready to face a new future. Excuse, gentlemen, is an important word. Those of you who have taken philosophy 9 may remember that I always speak of excuse there too. To do away with the cause. If you say excuse me after you have tread on my toes, you mean to say that your treading on my toes would cause anger. You see? Now you say, excuse me, so that this anger may not come to pass as a natural effect of your treading on my toes. Any excuse then breaks continuity, gentlemen. And Israel stands before God as excusing the Gentiles. It makes excuses for the rest of humanity who are fallen into their country, into their environment, or fallen into the worship of their ancestors. And that is the function of Israel, gentlemen. On the Day of Atonement, it is like sitting on the other side of a balancing beam, you see. These people, by gravity, sink down into the slime of Egypt or into the curbstones of New York, sidewalks of New York, and become New Yorkers and or Americans, and the Jews stand on the or sit on the other side and try to connect again these localized and these nationalized racist groups to their destination. It's a terrible wrestling match. Can you see this before you? That the excuse the Jews make to God for their fellow men is that they don't know better and that he should be patient and come again and eradicate these chains by which the Egyptians are nothing but Egyptians and the Americans nothing but Americans. Let us be better than Americans, is the Day of Atonement says, and let us be better than Irish Presbyterians. This is very practical, gentlemen. You have to have in every society, whether they call themselves Jews, such people who are waiting for the coming of the Lord. In this country, the Quakers play this role. The function of Israel, of course, today is with the Mormons, it is with the Quakers. It isn't at all now limited to those who say that or know that they are Israelites. The true Israel is wherever this atonement is celebrated and lived, and the price is paid for it. What's the price the Jews pay for it, this gentleman? That's the law, the fence of the law. Breaks all the myth of the environment. When a Jew dines with a tribesman, and a Bedouin, he doesn't eat what the Bedouin eats. So the myth that this is the only order of life, the tribal order, is broken. And when a Jew lives in Egypt, he doesn't celebrate the Egyptian New Year, but he has his Day of Atonement instead. So, gentlemen, the law, the Jewish ritual, the Jewish, how do you call them, eating and drinking prescriptions, this is an aggression, an act of hostility against the mythical order in which in the pagan world prevails, that you have to do as the Romans do. And the Jew says, I won't. I will not do as the Romans do in Rome. I will do otherwise. He does not claim that the others should join him because he is a living protest against their taking their ritual as sacred. He says it's just worldly.
So, gentlemen, the fence of the law around this little tiny 12 tribes of Israel is an attempt not to proselytize, not to break down the ritual or the nationality of others, but to debunk it as being merely worldly, as being secular, as having not the right to say that to use fork and knife is sacred. You can also eat with wooden sticks, as in China, can you not? But as you know, in a society that is limited to itself, you have to, every little break of the table manners already excommunicates you, for example. So the discipline of Israel is remarkable by not eating the pig's meat. They simply excluded themselves from the temple services of the empires because the pig could be fed very well in all these temple yards for sacrificial purposes. So this meat was the first available. And so with all the other prescriptions. Gentlemen, the law of Israel does not make sense in itself. It's a breaking of the taboos of the tribes and the empires. And this purpose it has served. Do not try to rationalize and say that pigs give you trichinosis. And that's why the Jews had hygienic rules of this kind. That's one of the silliest explanations of the Old Testament, but it has been the prevailing wind in the last 150 years when people lost their mind and became insane and they called it scientific. Because they tried to explain away the whole grandeur of the Israel enterprise. Israel's enterprise is not to be a people by themselves. It is not the attempt to be a nation. It is not the attempt to have a special religion. It is nothing of the kind. It's an attempt to tie back the whole of mankind to its destiny. And look, since 1900 years, all Christianity has taken in some of these Israelitic powers, and as I told you, I have just given you the Latter-day Saints, or the Seventh-day Adventists I could give, or the Jehovah's Witnesses. They all are branches from this tree of atonement. All these Jehovah's Witnesses, what they do is preach you that this world has to go, to which you belong, and that's nothing but the world. And you say, but the United States, that's sacred, isn't it? So you have again this balance of power in your heart. You have to wrestle with the amount of devotion which you owe your country and the amount of freedom with which you can escape from your country. The relation between cause and despite is always a living man's, you see, endeavor. You always have to know why, when do you act because and when you act despite. Is this clear? To show you in which subtle manner Moses went about this, I'll come back to the seven generations and the 12 tribes and the Sabbaths. The naturalistic explainers of everything in Israel, who said, oh, they had just one God in their desert and they had nationalistic tendencies and so on, have of course also held that the week, the Hebrew week, was nothing but an astrological derelict of the lunar cycle. Now, gentlemen, it so happens that 7 days are not one quarter of a lunar cycle. Do you know how long a lunar cycle is? Eh? Oh, no, it's 29 days and a quarter. And it's one of the big lies. I have tried to show this in 365, that men at first was interested in a lunar calendar. He wasn't. He was interested in a solar calendar, in a sun calendar. The Jews
have invented the weak, gentlemen, in antagonism against the astrologers. The weak is the expression of their contempt for astrology by one little trick. You know what the trick is? What's the difference, gentlemen, between the subdivisions called month of a solar year with its 12 months and the revolutions of the week in Judaism and in Christianity? Can you find out yourself? You know it, but you have never thought of it because you are too, of course, too proud for looking into these great things of the which surround you and which keep you free, and which are threatened today because you don't know how delicate the balance between freedom and law is in your own life. What is the difference between a week, gentlemen, and 1/12 of 360 days? You remember that a month is 1/36 or 1/12 of 360 days, and then the 5 days extra of the new year. Has the week of the Druze anything to do with that? What's the difference? Gentlemen, on December 31st, 1957, this year will end. Has this any influence on the week? Has this any influence on the week? No. That's the great innovation of the Jews. That the weeks and the Sabbaths and the work days have absolutely nothing to do with 365 days in the heavens. It has nothing, is nothing celestial. It's God's and men's atonement that they are working 6 days for themselves, bending over their plot of land and looking out for their family subsistence, and then look up one day to the Father, their Father, who is beyond heaven and earth because he created both. And therefore, gentlemen, this little fact that on December 31st it is Monday, and then January 1st it is Tuesday, is your own mortgage to liberty, your own relation to spiritual liberty that you are not astrologers. It is very small. Before Judaism is small. It's a tiny speck on the map. It is a very small thing. It is one half of mankind's history. Israel is tremendous in its significance. It is nothing as to numbers. Why must this lawyer, Mr. Dulles, with all his lying and shallowing and so on, he must respect their existence. Can't get out of it. He's bound by history to respect them. He would love to have them erased from the map of the world. It can't be done. Why has it to be tolerated? It's like the Tennessee Valley Authority and creeping socialism. Even Mr. Eisenhower had to bow to the existence of the Tennessee Valley Authority because it represents the next step in mankind's integration of power. You can't go behind it because you love 1860. And in the same way, Judaism is the future. You cannot let this Near East backslide into feudalism and the slime of the Nile and the Bedouins and Ibn Saud's slaveholders' tyranny. You cannot, even if you like to, even if you are bound by all material interests of oil companies and so on, to do so. Because even at this moment, the Israelites represent the future. No, gentlemen, the weak, which the chambers of commerce at this moment want to take away from you by saying that you will have a predictable year, and that in every year Sunday will be in the same day of the month, and so on and so forth. These fantastic plans of our planners, you have to break them. Your own soul is at stake, gentlemen. God is only God beyond heaven and earth if your year, at least the week, is not dependent on any constellation in the sky. If Monday is Monday, because it follows the day of the Sunday and it follows the Sabbath day. And the Christians, of course, have inherited this from Judaism, that the week rolls beyond across the years.
Use this word roll in your notes. It rolls on. The Jew is a weak gentleman of... the rabbis don't even know it. All these liberal rabbis have lost their story, their great story, what a week is. A week is not a part of a month. It is not a part of a year. It's something independent. It is that part of time by which you and I are allowed, you see, always to break out of heaven and earth and to approach our Maker. Don't you see that only through this Sabbath does the Creator become reality? If you wouldn't give him one day in which you are neither an astrologer and a stargazer, nor a tiller of the soil, you see, God wouldn't be believed by you. He would not have any power in your life. And if he would alter the weekdays, each 1st of January, we would express our belief that the sun really makes our lives and our work and our rest. Can you see this? Oh, it's a conspiracy, gentlemen, that in no textbook is it even mentioned. Because we are all Greeks. All our science is Greek. And the Greeks, of course, have inherited from Egypt the pure astronomy, you see, and think that time can only be measured by the stars. The week is not measured by the stars. This is the first insight you must gain, gentlemen, that Judaism is anti-astrological as it is anti-mythical. Anti. It doesn't want to have any such dependency. The corollary of this attitude, of course, is that the Jewish New Year and the Jewish New Moon had to be observed on the spot. We talked about this at Easter time, that Easter also is something really observed. The full moon after the equinox can be seen this year, 1957, in the sky. And you can make sure that God this year wants it this way. If you have astrology with 1460 years of ephemerides of astronomical tables and lists, then you predict. Then you do not rely on your senses and on your life of today, but then you are just caused by this wheel of within wheels which comes back with certainty, you see, in a mechanical way. The Jews said, beware of any such predictors. Our prophets have taught us that we must not have stargazers, we must not have ivory towers, we must not have observatories. But here we stand, and as soon as the new moon, the 12th and the 13th in the year appears, messengers were sent out from Jerusalem to the whole of the Jewish diaspora to say, now celebrate the new year. It's an observed thing, the new year in Israel, and not a predicted thing. It's an perceived, you even may say. It's a, at this moment, God is still free to order the fact. Perhaps this year the new moon comes another day. They would, you see, they were very consequential, very logical in the sense that they said no. Another way, gentlemen, of breaking taboos comes from the consideration that they had to get out of the tribal order. In the tribal order, the father has the total authority, the ancestral spirit, over the living. And therefore, he must, in order to procreate the virtue of the past, he must dispose of the lifeblood of the earth. Human sacrifice, you just have to look at the horoscope fresco number 2 downstairs. Human sacrifice is essential to the strengthening of the spirit of the ancestors. That's the altar. The blood on the altar, you see, hearts respects the occasions, and the young have to expiate for all their crimes by giving their life for it. Iphigenia in Greece has to be sacrificed so that Agamemnon can go to war to against Troy successfully. Have you ever thought how inappetizing these nice Greeks are? They seem to be so beautiful, but it isn't so very nice that the father sacrifices his son. Tantalus sacrifices Pelops and gives them to eat to the gods, and Agamemnon sacrifices his daughter. Gentlemen, the tribes are horrid. Because the future is sacrificed to the past. Now, the Israelites want to say that the future is sovereign. God is free.
and we, his children, are free. So Abraham is shown how he is tempted, as Jesus in the desert. He's tempted to slaughter his Isaac, to think he's just another tribe of sheep. And so he says, yes, I go and slaughter Isaac. But then the last minute he learns that blood, the times of bloody sacrifice are over, that Israel is not meant to become one tribe, but become the peoples of the earth. And there he gets this great prophecy that he shall people the earth like the with the grains of sand, his progeny shall be. And it has come out. They are all Jews. You like it or not? Spiritually, the Pope has said 50 years ago, the great Pope in Rome has said, spiritually, we all are Jews. There is nobody in China, gentlemen. Mr. Mao, of course, is Jewish infiltrated. He's a Marxist. And the Marxist, Marx believes in the future. And that nobody believed before in the future. And he has this from his Jewish ancestors, from the prophets. That's why you cannot proselytize Mr. Mao or the Chinese with this little bit of standard of living which you have to offer, with your Egyptian flesh pots. That will make never any impression on any Chinese, gentlemen. You have to become Christians if you want to convert the Chinese again to some cooperation with yourself. 400 million customers was a satanic book written by a man in this country 40 years ago, 30 years ago, in which he propagated that we should lure all the Egyptians in smoking cigarettes. And by sending millions of cigarettes cost-free to Egypt, to China, and once they get the custom, the Duke Tobacco firm would be safe. This is satanic, that's Egyptian, gentlemen. It's a famous book, gentlemen. All businessmen loved it. 400 million customers, it's called. I recommend it highly for knowing in what world you live. 400 million customers. Who can resist? The Jews could resist, gentlemen. The Jews have resisted this lure of the 400 million customers, and that's their merit. Can you understand? The Jews introduced circumcision, and that may seem to you a very crude custom. The children are circumcised in the first week of their existence in Israel. And the Gentiles, by the way, now too. Why? In the tribe, gentlemen, all the ritual around the sex were used on the dancing ground to introduce the young into the orgies, the dances, on the dancing ground of the tribe. Therefore, circumcision had something to do with becoming adult, with manhood, with becoming mature. So the Jews said, if we leave it to this age, in our own environment, in our own group, then the becoming a member of Israel will always be surrounded by these cruel rites. Let us advance it. The baby knows nothing of this. So it can not one of us can defect and become a tribesman, because the incisive step, the painful initiation, has already happened at a time when he has no memory for this. This is the great wisdom of circumcision, and to anticipate such a breaking of a taboo by Christianity. As you know, John the Baptist baptized the repenting ones after they already had lived. A similar idea of having a rite coming later. And that's why we have children's baptism. And that's the refutation of the Baptists in this country. That for good reason, the baptism should not, or by water, should not be confused for the baptism of our heart in fire, for the baptism by fire, you see. So you give the water baptism as to the child, so that the grown-up can undergo the real baptism of fire. This is exactly the same idea of the Jews, that they demand that the baby is circumcised, you see, so that the grown-up
boy or man can enter atonement and is not confused because there's such an important ritual like circumcision hitting him in the middle of life. If you look at me, can you follow? This is one way, then, gentlemen, of the breaking a taboo by advancing it and therefore making it unimportant. It's innocuous. If you have done it in a time when it doesn't touch your soul, when it is just done, and it has lost its sacred character. It's an act which others have performed for you as a circumcision. Perhaps we have a break here. Now we have mentioned writing, we have mentioned circumcision, we have mentioned many such ways of eliminating the sacred power of heaven and earth and of ancestry upon the mind and the heart of a living member of Israel, so that he may resist the temptation of hanging back and thinking that this country is already the destiny of our Creator. He created heaven and earth, of course, has also the impact that he didn't create the United States unless they remain a part of heaven and earth. So it works both ways. If you believe that God created heaven and earth, it means that neither heaven nor earth has sanctity, but it also means the other way around, that no smaller part, for example the sun, or for example America, or for example Albania, has a claim to your complete loyalty. The law around this Jewish people has kept them going as perceivable, how would you say, of making themselves felt. When Frederick the Great of Prussia joked with a Christian minister and said, after all, you have no argument for the existence of Christianity, this Christian minister, with great presence of mind, answered, oh yes, your majesty, the Jews, they are our demonstration of the existence of Christianity. It is the only demonstration today that Christianity is not a myth, gentlemen. It's that there are Jews from whom Christianity has sprung. That's quite important, but it was even more important in antiquity, that the Jews were the only group that said that the gods of the pagans were not God, and the spirits of the ancestors were not the spirit. We have a report of Roman historians, gentlemen, in which they say still in the days of Christ that the Jews had managed to keep the name of their God a secret. I think that's a very pertinent remark by which you can imagine the role of Jews in a non-Christian world, in all pre-Christian societies. Their function is to say that all the name gods, Isis and Osiris, you see, have nothing to do with the true God. If you read the Bible carefully, you will find that the gods of the Gentiles are always acknowledged to be gods. The word gods occurs in the Bible. But God is not any of these gods. God, the true God, the only God, is the God who has created heaven and earth. The celestial or earthly powers, Demeter and Zeus, are not God. They are demons, spirits. They are gods. I think I must tell you this, gentlemen, because the future of the human race is bound up with your power. To understand polytheism, the many gods of science, of sports, of Dartmouth College, of alumni feelings, of family feelings, as real gods. They are gods in your life, gentlemen. You follow them. But you must know that they are not God. I want to bring out this very clearly, gentlemen. In this sense, we are back to antiquity, that we can no longer understand the world in which we live, if you do not see that at any moment some part of the world tries to act like a god in your own life. America at this moment tries. This textbook, The America, History of the American Nation, irks me terribly because it attempts to create a pseudo-god. There is no American nation, fortunately. We are bigger than a nation. If you, however, have to learn the history of the American nation, we'll have the next world war. Because it is a deification without any reason of a part of the universe, you see, of a part of heaven and earth, and certainly made separate into a separate thing which has no common language with the rest of mankind. You see, we cannot afford this. The English have an established church, so Britain is always a Christian country. The King Queen is called the defender of the faith. But we have an agnostic country. Officially, America doesn't know anything of the existence, the government of America, of Christianity, of Judaism, of God, the living God. We have suppressed all mentioning of the creator of heaven and earth in our documents. The Freemasons have looked to that. And therefore, if we say the American nation, it is suddenly a godless nation. Because nation is a pagan expression by itself. We have no document now in our constitution which connects America with the creator of heaven and earth. And so you see this today, this desertion, this defection. You see that the Chamber of Commerce here is urging upon us a purely mechanical calendar where the week would have no, be enslaved by the year. That's just it shows you the total blindness and deafness of these businessmen in this country. They don't know what they're doing. They go to church and at the same time they disconnect the established order of America with this gain of freedom from nature, from environment, from the heavens, from the sky, from science, from all this nonsense. Second-rate orders. They are only second-rate. And nobody sees how we are backsliding today into a time which has never before existed in this country, where America goes purely natural. Gentlemen, a natural country has to be destroyed because it is a stumbling block to the coming of the Lord. You cannot live by nature as a mere nation. You can live as the new world, we can live as a melting pot of nations, we can live as the heirs, as we were proclaimed in 1780, the heirs of Japhet, Ham, and Sem, all the children of men coming to this country and forming a new commonwealth and a new unity, a fraternity. But you cannot live by history of the American nation. Then we have nothing to offer the rest of the world. Then we only look at China as a market for 400 million customers. And you are in this danger, gentlemen. It is your business to stop that nonsense. If you don't, you will be cursed. And I mean cursed in every sense of the word. Nothing you can do will then be of any avail. The Russians and the Chinese will line up against us and will first take, of course, get Asia, that's very simple, and then they will isolate us and finally throttle us. At this moment, the Americans have given up the spirit of God. They want to have the spirit of their ancestors, 100% red Americanism, or you want to have the spirit of your environment. 48 states within this little tiny speck of continent. What's your offer? What's your connection with the rest of the human race? It has always been the glory of the United States that they were the in vanguard of the reunification of mankind. So it's all very practical what I tried to tell you, gentlemen. The relation of Israel, Egypt, and tribe in your heart is eternal. There is no human being that does not have to make this same decision between atonement, at-one-ment, with the coming will of God, its loyalty to his environment, his country, his soil, and his family, his ancestors. You all have to make this decision. I have to make this decision, every one of us. So I have tried to tell you that this Egypt, Israel, and clan totemistic clan, there's nothing outside of your own existence, gentlemen. You realize it every day. Every letter you write home is clannish. Every course you take here is Egyptian. And every plan you make for the future, every choice of profession or of marriage is Jewish. Nobody can get out of this. Therefore, all these attitudes of life had to be created in antiquity as possibilities to be offered everyone. That's the greatness of the story. Now, the story of Israel in itself, of course, had to gain time. And the result of this time-gaining process, which was exactly as from Horus to Apis. I've tried to tell you that the Egyptian history was the same Egypt, or forever, and yet a turning around from one aspect of Egypt to the other. And you remember that he made it in 4 points. Horus, Ra, Osiris, and Isis. One of the reported gentlemen didn't understand the second step at all. He said 700 years after the Horus, the people discovered that the sun was rising in the east and setting in the west. They had discovered this before. I mean, such childish remarks should really not be made by you. The sun rises for several 100,000 years, I suppose, and sets. No. The story was, as you remember, in Egypt, that the domineering group, the entourage of Horus, the followers of Horus, the mighty warrior king, the falcon, who flies from the south and carries the sun on his wings to the north, had no practical application in the life of a peasant who just plods along on the Nile River from one shore to the other. And it was paying attention to his vision which led to the pharaoh's condescension to say, now you will understand this, me, Horus, the royal falcon, I am with you as the son of Ra. I behave as, you see, in connection with your experience that the great truth of life is the daily movement. And I think I should mention this to you, gentlemen. The sign for Ra, the sun. In Egypt is the sun a sign also for one day. But the sign for the year and for Sirius is the pyramid. In other words, gentlemen, the year is not called with any symbol of the sun. That's why we know that Horus is older than Ra as a political figure, as an idea, as a dominating symbol for the Egyptian order. Because the Egyptians were out to organize a year economy, an annual economy. The concession made to the peasant is that Horus also enters the daily life of ceremonial living, you see, from morning to evening. And therefore, it is terribly important, I told you, there has never been sun worship in the world. That's one of the orgies of modern anthropologists. This means day. Now, a day cannot be politically important. The days are not organizable, they're too short. But they are important for the daily experience of laborers, of children, of families, of workers. And I think it may help you, that's why I thought I should come back to this, to know that the hieroglyph for day and the hieroglyph for sun in Egypt proves that the sun was not the organizer of Egypt ever. Can you understand? We have now a parallel development in the Bible itself. The Bible is 24 books, and the first part of the Bible are the 5 books of Moses. And they deal with the establishment of Israel, and that corresponds to Horus, to the phase of the founders, the heroic age, the days of Washington and Jefferson and Adams.
The second phase is the story from the Joshua to, we may say, Josiah, to make a pen. That is the story of taking up the settlement and of the promised land, leaving the desert and taking upon themselves the plight of staying put and waiting. And the third story are the prophets and the sons of David. And the fourth part are the books of wisdom. If we look at this development, gentlemen, you will see that it has a very similar rhythm as the Egyptian stories, that in order to last, a certain circling around on this long-range firmament is inevitable. People have to live, people consume ideas, they consume words, you see, the interest has to be kept up. What is this story of these four parts of the Bible? The five books of Moses end with the death of Moses. It is the greatness of Moses that his grave is unknown and his birthplace is unknown. He was born in the Nile, hidden in the Nile away. So that's also a breaking of the taboo, you see. Why do you shake your head? What's so difficult? Moses' grave is unknown, the Old Testament says. If it had been known, there would have been a cult around his grave. See? And that was forbidden. Can you see this? And Moses is called the man of God. And God is he who shall be there where he hasn't been before. Therefore, since Moses is to remind the children of Israel that he is the first prophet, he cannot be worshipped at his grave, otherwise he would spoil the doctrine, the summons, the admonition expressed by his life, that he's waiting to hear the command of God tomorrow. Can you see this? It's perhaps was the greatest sentence in the Old Testament. This one little sentence, you don't know how to read the Bible, you see, the little sentences are the greatest sentence in the Bible. This one word, and the grave of the tomb of Moses is known to this day. The fifth book of Deuteronomy, which for the last 50 years has been discarded as a priest's book and whatnot. The Deuteronomy is the most incredible book in the history of the human race, because it knows the price to be paid for the existence of a true faith in the future. A terrible price. No art, no visibility, not even the grave, because in this environment it would lead to worship at the grave. And that must not be. So Moses has to forego all visible memory. Monumentalness. To have no monument is monumental in itself. You see, in a time and environment where everybody craves monument. This is his monument, gentlemen. That's what the Bible is the Egyptian temple and the tribal mosque. The Bible is the one incarnation of Israel. But it is an incarnation in a strange way. You must understand that this is the greatness of Israel, that there is no such work as the Bible. This book is written for over 1500 years. And a book that is written in 1500 years in a time today in which the books of the rebellion in Hungary already count by the score, printed, published, sold to the public. There are now, at least I have seen it advertised, 12 books on the uprising in Israel, in Hungary. Utter nonsense. But that's how we live.
you see, minute by minute. And here's the Bible written and distilling the experience of 3,000 years of the human race and composed within 1,500 years. That's a book. And that's superb. And that's why it is a book of books and will remain to the end of the world, gentlemen. Whether you read it or not, you will be forgotten as soon as you stop reading the Bible. The Bible will not be forgotten. You cannot make forget the Bible, but you can become the forgotten man, as the Americans very soon will be. If you live by movies, gentlemen, and by television, you deserve to be forgotten. God didn't create you for the second. He created you to live 70 years in peace with your first and to ancestors and with your last great-grandchildren. That's your problem. That's the only problem you have. For the moment, you don't have to worry. Your only worry, however, is for the moment. That's why I have to stress this, gentlemen. If there wasn't the Bible, it would be ununderstandable what the Jews had to sacrifice. They had to sacrifice the beauty of the tribal worship of life. And they had to sacrifice the imperial worship of magnificent dead things. And so what they had to save was the speech of the human heart. In its pains, the Psalms, and in its despair, in its environment, the prophets, you see, and in its reports on the saving grace among their ancestors. Every Jewish sentence, so to speak, begins, "The God who led the children of Israel out of Egypt." It's called Exodus here in the book, but as you know, there is no prayer in Israel, as far as I know, at least, which contains not this one sentence, this breaking in into environment and tribe, you see, or by the hand of God who comes and changes the environment. That's the first part. God as the changer of background and environment. The God who takes Abraham out of his friendship, out of his kin, you must say, you see, out of his blood, out of his generation, out of the Semites. That is why it is such a refined thing not to be anti-Jewish, but call himself an anti-Semite, gentlemen. You cannot be anti-Semites if you want to hate the Jews, because the Semites are the born hatreds of the Jews, the Arabs, for example. Of course, it's a reproach to the Semites that mere descent doesn't do, but the will of God has set apart the Jews from the Semites. Yes, it was a very cheap thing, gentlemen, to die, disguise the hatred of the Bible and of the carrier of the revelation of God into this term anti-Semitism. You should rise beyond this, gentlemen. You should know that anti-Semitism is an attempt to secularize your hatred of the revelation. Any pagan man in you, the Greek in you, the sportsman and so hates Judaism because it says no art, no sports, no gods, or no other gods but me. The will of God tomorrow will dispossess, or must be able to dispossess, everything you have. It's not good enough. That's very disturbing. So, of course, the hatred of the Jews is as old as the existence of the Jews. It's part of their story. The Egyptians had to go to war. The tribes are on the warpath. Against the Jews, one couldn't very well wage war. They had nothing to offer. Such a small country. They had, you see, they retreated within themselves. They didn't make converts. But you had to hate them just the same. And it takes the form, of course, of all kind of masks and ways, it's hate, not war, which persecutes the Jews. But the persecution of the Jews are as old as the existence of Israel, and must be. As long as there is Israel and Gentiles, then this must be. Read St. Paul and he will tell you that it is only when the whole world is no longer pagan that the hatred of the Jews can cease. Before it cannot.
the existence of paganism must find expression in the hatred of the messianic people, and vice versa. The messianic people must exist as long as the pagans are pagans and believe in the standard of living. And he is a Jew who is not for the standard of living, and it doesn't make a difference. Today, these so-called Jews, mostly in America, are of course the idolaters of the standard of living, and the real Jews are the people who have nothing to do with the physical Judaism. You mustn't be betrayed. Today that is all a little difficult to find out. The Latter-day Saints, I suppose, are nearer to the kingdom of heaven today than the many people who happen to have Jewish names or a Jewish descent. The main point is that this tripartition between people who listen to the demand of atonement and the people who defend their environment and their background is eternal. That cannot be helped. Now, anti-Semitism, as I told you, is an attempt to secularize this hatred. The world, which the Jews always debunk, and for officials say that's nothing but worldly. The Jews feel the world feels terribly slighted, and so they say these Semites, you see, they bring this stir in the world. But now we come to the Semites themselves, and they're just as anti-Jewish as the Europeans, the Indo-Europeans, or however you call the non-Jewish group in Europe and in America. And the Arabian question, therefore, is very fruitful for waking you up to the fact that you better say frankly that you hate the Jews. If you say that you are anti-Semite, it doesn't help you anymore. It is just not so. You love Ibn Saud and Nasser. You support it. So you are not anti-Semites. They are Semites, are they not? They are the real Semites. The Jews have long ceased to be Semites. That's just Abraham, who showed that you can. He went, and the Bible begins, therefore, the story of Abraham. He left his kindred. You see, there is a renunciation of mere tribalism. The tribe, gentlemen, is based on seven generations, the knowledge of seven generations. On a totem pole, there are, in most tribes, seven eyes. That's the self-consciousness of a tribe, I told you, over 150 years. That's Moses was faced with the problem of how to break the taboos. The year is divided into 12 units. The generations are divided into seven. So he mixed metaphors in a very strange way, and I'm convinced, I cannot prove it to you, but I'm convinced, and I hold to it, that he said explicitly to himself, that Israel must be prevented from backsliding into tribalism and backsliding into empires. Therefore, I gave 12 tribes and 7 days of the week. Then my week cannot become part of astrology, and the tribes, my nation cannot go back into tribes, because 12 tribes, that's astrology, and 7 days, that's tribalism. And so he transferred the seven from the tribal order to his calendar for his country, for his harvest and his Pesach and his celebrations of his year, you see, which is climatic and environmental and Egyptian. And in this lies the greatness of the Bible, that you find that it is written against tribe and empire at the same time. Every word in the Bible tries to break a taboo, a superstition, which hangs on men if he only lives in his blood group, or if he only lives in his soil, in his earthly and celestial firmamental environment. I think that is my answer. Who asked about the seven? You remember? Everything in the Bible, the age of the patriarchs, everything is meant to break the chain of causation. And that's why seven in the calendar breaks the chain of causation. There is nothing in the calendar that corresponds to seven. And the 12 There's nothing in the life of the people that has anything to do with 12, you see. But 7 has to do with the 12, and 12 has to do with the calendar. So my conclusion is that he did this very wisely and of his very great purpose. And he has succeeded. The success speaks for itself. The other three phases, gentlemen, in the Judaism are exactly as in the Egyptian thing. From Joshua to the last king, so gradually they are come back the interests of the local people. The high point of the second part is the building of the Temple of David, the great temple in Jerusalem, the first, and later the second. What does this mean, gentlemen? That the Jews were strong enough by that time, 950 BC, to allow themselves something like a Greek temple in Greece without inscriptions. So the Temple of Solomon, you see, is opened with the great word of King Solomon, God, we know that you cannot be worshipped in temples of stone. Just the same, we have allowed ourselves, taken the liberty to build one special place for your worship. The first sentence then in the Bible, gentlemen, about the temple is that it is a concession to the weakness of men. It isn't the sacred temple, you see, of Egypt. It's the opposite. People like temples, so let's have one, but do not exaggerate its importance. Gentlemen, the greatness of the Temple of Solomon is in the fact that it was built 300 years after Moses. That the Jews were abstemious enough to quarantine their soul for 300 years before they were allowed to have a temple with diminished importance as a worldly building. The Temple of Solomon has never been sacred, gentlemen. That's a mistake. Just read the opening, the inauguration of this temple. It's a great acknowledgement that in men's weakness, he wants to have a building, a visible building, but that God and men do not meet in this building, really. The temple, of course, followed the lines of least resistance. It had 365 pillars to depict the 365 days, you see, of the year. It was built according to type. It was nothing original. The Temple of Solomon is nothing very important except for its late date. It repeats, gentlemen, the greatness of Moses, who dies without a grave and does not enter the promised land. So that when the promised land was taken up and the second Egypt was created, the best man, Moses, the man of God, was not with it. So that the Jews knew they had already been Israel before they went into this land, because if their greatest founder had to stay outside, you see, and had already given them the whole spirit, then the country could never acquire the label with the sanctity, you see, of a second Egypt, of a cut out heaven on earth, of a Templar society. Can you see this? That Moses staying outside Palestine, for all the future, desecrated the importance of Palestine compared to the spirit, you see, that led them out of Egypt. Again, I mean, I think, the more I live to understand it, that Moses has an incredible greatness, because he paid the penalty for all the things he wanted to achieve. He gave up all self-glorification, all visible success, and he had to. Otherwise, the Jews could have never purified themselves from Egypt and from trial. It's literally truth. The Bible says the story so simply as I tell you this now, that he managed to get a people on their legs who could say that they existed outside the empires and outside the tribes. Outside the empires and outside the tribes, that's the Jewish problem. Otherwise, they couldn't wait for the future. Gentlemen, his last expression, then I'm so, of this is that from the very beginning, the Jews say that God can transform the bush into fruitland and fruitland into bush. That is, the old division of the earth in jungle, bush for nomads, you see, without boundaries, without settlements. And
the fruit land of Egypt with the square gardens and the prophets, you see, falls under the marching people of God. Sometimes they settle, sometimes they don't settle. Fruit land can become desert if people are breaking the law and not cursed by their law, and desert can become fruit land. It has very much impressed me when I read this verse in the Old Testament. My eyes were then open for the first time for the real meaning of the Israelitic attitude that the earth is the Lord's, and therefore desert and fruitland are not, you see, determining men's fate. He is free to change this. He can become a city dweller and he can cease to be a city dweller. All liberties which you take upon yourself and take them for granted that they had to be created. Your own liberty of roaming and being one time a gentleman farmer and the next time less gentleman-like banker, it is based on the Bible's message that you are not children of your environment. Thank you.